Welcome to The Late Set. I'm Nate Chenin.
I'm Josh Jackson.
Josh, do you have much of a relationship with South Korean jazz?
Thank you for asking, Nate. as a matter of fact, I don't, except for South Korea pressed a Pat Metheny record, and that's the only way you can get this record. It's that beautiful solo record he did, What's It All About?
Wow.
They pressed it in South Korea. But as it relates to South Korean jazz, which is your actual question, I'm sad to say that I know very little, but I'm hoping to learn more by the end of this episode of The Late Set.
Well, you know, it's interesting because in one sense, the question is, it's the wrong question as it pertains to this artist, because I don't know that that's even the intention, but it has to do with materials. So our guest this episode is Doyeon Kim, who is a virtuoso of the gayageum, a traditional Korean zither.
Yeah.
Some of them have 12 strings. Some of them have 25 strings. This is an instrument whose origins go back thousands of years. And I'm pretty sure that that her expression as an improviser marks the first really notable effort to bring the gayageum into, you know, jazz practice. It's, you know, she's really kind of the first.
I wonder if at any point in the 14 or so years that I lived in New York that I maybe saw a performance on some version of this instrument.
There's a good chance.
I'm wondering.
Yeah. I mean, you probably saw your share of like jazz crossover events at the Asia Society,
yes,
right? You know, one artist who has played the gayageum in an improvisational setting is Jen Hsu.
Okay.
But she does not use it to improvise so much as to, you know, set a foundation for her vocalizing, which is more improvisational.
Right.
So we're talking about a slightly different process. But Doyeon, you know, went to the New England Conservatory to study music and encountered a lot of encouragement, especially from the great guitarist Joe Morris. And he sort of, he said, you know, you have like a voice on this instrument. Like you're doing something. You have a personality here, and, you know, you should think about bringing that out and becoming an improviser, you know? And so, although she had not come up, you know, listening to jazz as much, she really latched on to that scene and, you know, the freedoms that made possible for her. And she's really fearless, you know, this is the thing, is like, she just plunged right in and made a lot of connections, and I think has, in a fairly short amount of time, become a kind of an essential voice on the creative music scene, and a very different voice, you know, doing something that comes from another place.
So what are the implications of, let's call it, organized sound as it relates to this particular instrument? Like, what is it that makes this kind of work within the context of some of the people that she was inspired by?
Well, it's a very percussive sound, of course.
Yeah.
You know, it's an instrument that doesn't have a lot of natural resonance. You know, like you really have to work to create sound, and certainly you have to work to sustain sound. And so, it's very, there's a lot of like energy transfer required, and she knows how to do that. She knows how to really make it speak. Now, she also vocalizes, and this is a sort of an integral thing. She tells a funny story in our conversation about how that happened. You know, I think it was a gig with Tony Malaby, you know, this session, and just a whole bunch of people sort of caterwauling, making all kinds of noise, and she was struggling to have herself be heard. And so she was like shouting. and Tony was like, hey, that was cool what you were doing. You should try that again, you know? And she then, you know, figured out, oh, like, actually people really respond when I sing. She's not a trained singer, but she's a very compelling one. You know, she's got a great voice, terrific presence, and it's very dramatic. You know, that's another thing. She sort of trained as a dancer. And so she has this sort of performer's instinct. Seeing her live is really something else because she, you know, she's sitting behind this plank-like instrument and she's like, you know, swaying and like her hands are just moving around. You know, it's a very like visually arresting presentation. And then the vocals will sort of nail you to the spot.
And it's also, I would imagine, a very physical performance.
Totally, yeah. Totally. It was really something to sit on stage. And, you know, in our interview, at one point I asked her to illustrate a point musically. And so she played a solo improvisation and I was sitting right next to her and right next to the instrument. And I've got to say that the sound coming off of it was very cool to witness at such close range. And then, you know, after the interview, this is something that this is the bonus cut here. I was sort of asking about the instrument itself, you know, and I asked about like the provenance of it, how old it was. And something I did not know about the Gayagum is that the wood that they use to make these, it comes from a kind of tree. And I'd have to look up what sort of tree it is, but it's a tree that does not age that well. And so unlike you think about, you know, the tradition of classical instruments.
Sure.
And, you know, it's very desirable if you have like an 1800s, you know.
Guarneri.
Yeah. Like, in the case of the Gayagum, they basically last like 15 or 20 years.
Huh.
And so the instrument she was playing at Solar Myth, I think maybe she'd had it for 5. But it kind of threw me for a loop because I was like, oh, is this a Gayagum from the 1930s or, you know, whatever?
Yeah.
She's like, no, it was made like 10 years ago or whatever.
So the tonal characteristics just seem to change in a sort of an...
it's a soft wood, apparently.
Oh, okay, I see. Like a balsa
and so, yeah. So it just doesn't... I guess it just degrades or sort of loses its resonance over time. So,
gotcha.
So it's just a different... it's a different way of thinking about the vintage of an instrument. But it's the one she had was beautiful, had a beautiful inlay. There's a certain symbology that she cares about and explains in our conversation, talks about sort of the heaven and the earth. And, you know, she's bringing this whole traditional framework, you know, all of this history and sort of significance of the instrument culturally into this new space, you know? And man, I got to say, she can throw down with anybody, you know? And that's in this kind of high energy, free improvisational context, that counts for a lot. You know, she will just jump in there.
Well, let's check out that conversation with Nate Janin and Doyon Kim at Solar Myth.
Welcome to The Late Set, and welcome to Solar Myth in South Philadelphia, and welcome to you, Doyon Kim.
Hello!
I got some intel coming in here this evening. Is it your birthday?
Today is my birthday, June 24th!
Oh my gosh, happy birthday!
Thank you so much!
Wow.
Thank you!
I think I speak for everyone, you know, coming to this show tonight. We are so honored that you are spending it with us.
Oh, of course, it's my honor.
Amazing. There's a lot to celebrate because you are having a wonderful year as an artist. You've released this album, Wellspring, that I think is going to come in for a lot of year-end acclaim. It's certainly on my list, and it's already received a lot of, you know, fantastic praise. And so congratulations.
Thank you so much. Thank you.
You've been working toward this for a while.
Oh, yes. Oh, yes.
How does it feel, you know, since this album has, you know, entered the world and been met with so much enthusiasm? You were at Big Ears this year and, you know, got to play for two different audiences, right? So there's just a lot. There's been a lot. And I wonder, you know, what is your experience of that?
I mean, like, you know, first of all, I really appreciate my team, you know, really advertised me, my manager Matt, and then the, you know, Tao Form, the label, they really support me a lot. So I think that this could be happen with, like, and if without them, you know, I cannot imagine how can I do everything myself.
Right.
So first of all, I really appreciate my team members, and then the other one is like, you know, this is my first album as a band leader, and all the music is about that kind of. Was my transition period that that I don't want to play music just for myself. I want to play for the world and then finding the meaning why I'm born and why I'm doing this. So kind of like my first try to shake my hand to the world. And it seems like the world really hold me back, the hands to me. It's really felt that way. It felt first when I composed this music, I even feel afraid a little bit, like, because before I was only focused about me, but now I don't want to talk about me. I want to talking something else. And when I found that, everything feels so new. I play music since I was 4, and then suddenly I felt like what should I do? Then why for now? And then I kind of finding my way, and it was start with a challenge, afraid, but also looking forward to it, little and the hope, and then it felt or realized again, okay, it's good to be try, good to be, you know, go forward to it, don't be afraid, let's do it.
Now some of that journey and that transitional time you mentioned was really beautifully told in a story for the New York Times by my friend Sean Brady, who is a great jazz journalist here in Philadelphia. And when I saw that piece online, I did like a fist pump because I was like, you know, what a great story. They did such a good job with it and really captured the details of your background. And I want to get into that. But first, I want to talk about your instrument. You play the gayagum. It's right here. Gorgeous instrument. This one is, what is this, 18 strings?
It's 25.
25 strings. See, I've never been good at counting.
But there is a 18-string gayagum.
Okay.
Yeah, there's a 12, 18, 25. Yeah.
Okay. So I have I haven't seen a lot of performance with gayagum. I've seen Jen Hsu perform, and I've seen a couple of other ensembles, but I feel a certain connection personally, and I'll just, you know, this is like some backstory from myself. My grandmother played koto. She was an Okinawan koto player, and so I grew up with this instrument like propped up in her bedroom. And I was a little kid, I would go and be like, what is this? You know, it was like much bigger than I was. And there is a, you know, sort of a familial connection between
those. Yeah, it's family.
Yeah. And I have listened to a bit of the classical repertoire, you know, like Hwang Byung-ki. And so I have some sense of what this instrument does, but I want to hear about your history with it and, you know, what you were playing on it as you were growing up.
Yeah, so as I say, I learned piano since I was 4. And in that time, you know, everyone in Korea, everyone, when they're young, they go to piano academy. And then you play, and then you feel like, you know, homework, you know.
Yeah.
This day, I love piano so much. I love, you know, piano concerto. The Bartok Piano Concerto number 3 is my favorite. Like, I really love it. But in the time, it felt like, it's hammer banging. You know, I felt that way. And then when I saw this instrument, that, first of all, I don't wear anything. I don't have any tool. I just directly pluck the string. And then I'm bending the note. So I create the sound directly and very delicately. So you feel like cooking. So like that, because like other instruments have a stick or bow or some certain like hammer or certain part of it, tools there, and then like vibration is going forward. But this one is direct.
Yeah.
Or from the lead, you know, the vibration through the lead is going. So like, it feels like very attached and very personal. So that's how I'm falling in love. And especially when you listen to the Korean traditional music, that the soulness, the full of the soulness is really, it taught me a lot. And then when I hear the Gayageum Sanjo, especially this, that when Gayageum Sanjo, in that time, I just quick become a dancer, or was 10. And again, I also learned the Korean traditional dance and ballet since I was 4 until 10. I was very serious, want to be a dancer. And so I have a hard time about, I just quit the dance. And then when I hear the Gayageum, it really comfort me. It feel like this instrument really understand that suddenly I don't have a dream. So that's why I'm falling in love right away in the time, yeah.
That's so interesting, because as I hear you talking about this, I just keep thinking about, you know, tactile, you know, like just the idea of the manipulation is all in your hands, right? But there's another element. I've seen some footage of you performing, and I know that you were a dancer, and there's a very kinetic kind of, you know, there's movement is important to you as a performer. And that feels, it just feels like it was not a far step for you to incorporate that. How does this instrument capture that for you?
I mean, you know, even when you play, you know, when you dance Korean traditional music, there's always feel like this kind of gesture about the rhythm. Like I already, you know, that's very how I feel the rhythm. And that rhythm, actually, when you see the dance, the Korean music, they are not counting 1, 2, 3, 4. They are not like ballet, like 1, 2, 3, 4. It's not counting as a grid. It's more like breathing. Like so, and then, so like, and then when you hear like, like already that feeling is here. So I'm like, you sing as like, you know, singing dance is kind of like score for me. And then even my movements or, you know, I'm breathing together. So it's all connected, like how I breathe, how I'm making a melody, like even some gesture. I think it's already in my gut. So I cannot take apart.
Yeah, yeah.
Sometimes I need to take apart. When
is there something there in the relationship between vibration and rhythm too?
I think, first of all, is the, even like when you Korea, when you say music, is we call the 국악, you know, already, even though 악 means music, but that also including dance. So we didn't separately seeing it, dance and music is already together. So 악, or that word, we include everything. So, and then how we feel the rhythm is different than Western rhythm. So already we share those common things that, you know, how we holding, breathing, and like breathe it out. That's already there. It's how I'm doing it in my, you know, they doing the dance, doing it visually. I'm doing the audibly. So it's I think there's nothing like, I think it's still connecting. It's also we are doing the same thing in a different, you know, sense.
The attack, that initial sound, you know, is very percussive. It's very strong. Mm-hmm. And in, you know, in the Western understanding, like there's a lot of focus on the attack and a little less focus on the decay or the sustain. But my understanding is that that part of the note is actually very important for the gayageum.
So in Korea, Korean traditional music, if you can sustain, even though you have a bow, your wind instrument and the percussive, the dot, you know, that's a string instrument. So it's connecting with the dot and line. Mm-hmm. So the gayageum purpose is we give a dot, and then the wind instrument cover with between the dot. So that's why, I mean, if I'm using a bow, it became I'm playing a wind instrument. Mm-hmm. Yeah, because I sustain.
Yeah. There's another aspect of your story, which is that you were growing up in Seoul and you came to North America, but North America to Vancouver for, was it a camp or was it?
Oh, it was. So I have a big adolescence time, you know, when I was in middle school, first year of the middle school. So my mom suddenly gave me the airplane ticket. Okay, have a fun year. Winter vacation in Korea, winter vacation is like 2 months and a half, almost 3 months. So I didn't know I'm gonna go to school in Victoria Island in Canada. Mm-hmm. And I suddenly go to school and I actually had so much fun over there. Like I felt like in Korea, I felt like I'm a very drama queen. Like my personality is so big, but over here they just accept me as who I am. I don't need to fit in to be some part of the group. So I was like, I felt like always in deep inside, my music, like I'm not wrong, I'm just different. Mm-hmm. But people say I'm wrong, so it makes me really doubt about it. And then when I went there, I found myself that this is I'm not wrong, I'm just different.
Mm-hmm. Was there something? So what I read in Sean's piece was that there was a moment around this time that you decided you wanted to go into cultural diplomacy.
Yes.
Can you talk about that?
Oh, yes. So in that time, it's 2004, five. Like, so yes, those time that, you know, in that time, People don't know at Korea at all. They using Samsung, LG, Hyundai, Kia, but they thought it's Japanese brand. So no! And then even I went to the museum, how they represent us is part of like China. Mm. I was so mad. I actually called the, you know, embassy, like, "Are you guys know about this?" Like, you know. So in that time, I thought, okay, I want to be a person who like let them know about the Korea. That's why I want to be an ambassador in first time. Yeah.
Yeah. That's really powerful. You know, that idea of like this culture is not being seen.
Yes.
You know? And it strikes me that this is, in a sense, this is what you are now doing within the, you know, the realm of creative music, you know, bringing an instrument that has not had a lot of champions in, you know, avant-garde, you know, improvised music. But it wasn't a straight line, right? So you went to school in New England.
Yes.
And as we're speaking, it's not only your birthday, but it's also, you know, the beginning of the Vision Festival in New York. Mm-hmm. And the Lifetime Achievement honoree, one of them this year, is Joe Morris.
Yes.
And Joe is a tremendous guitarist and bassist and educator.
Right.
And so I'd love to hear you talk about what it was like to encounter him and what he, how he brought you to this practice.
So until like my undergraduate at Seoul National University, I still like want to be prove myself so badly that because I want to do my music, not mimicking my teacher. So like, you know, I work really hard and got the best award I can get. So I thought, okay, I prove it. So can I do my stuff? But still, I'm young. So I was so struggled. So I want to be always to be perfect, perfect mimicking my teacher, perfectly play. I was always, my like mindset about the music is so like one, you know, should I say like one dimensional way.
Mm-hmm.
And when I moved to Boston and went to NEC, the Joel Morris was first person who taught me that, oh, what you're doing is different. And that one, I really want to hear from the person that, because I already know in deep inside, I'm just different. I'm not wrong. But he actually said that, Toyon, you're just different. You have different, you know, taste, idea, and you, which is unique. And that's who you are. Keep going. And like, really encouraged me. And at the same time, because my focus is about want to be a perfect and technically perfect, rhythmically perfect, like some like musically perfect. But I never thought about how I playing is actually coming from my deeper inner thought of me, not just my hand, where I, you know, felt and just no more thinking, all my taste, my instinct is, you know, it's all inner thoughts. And I never thought about it. And then he kind of talked about the bigger way of thinking of music, not just my technique, is also connecting with who I am with the music. So that was a like big, like waking up moment for me.
Yeah. I mean, yeah, that has to be a powerful catalyst, right?
Yeah.
And then it opens up possibilities for you to connect with all kinds of different musicians.
Yes.
Where it's, you don't really have to worry about, well, how is this going to work, or what is the, you know, what is the established sort of hierarchy or
right.
order? You know, it's like, that's, forget about all of that, right? It's about expression.
Mm-hmm.
So what was the next step for you? How did you then, you know, sort of having this light bulb go mm-hmm, off, like mm-hmm. What then happened for you?
Yes. And then I now open the Pandora box, you know, keep talking, communicate with me. That actually, even before, like, I recognize my limitation of the kayagam. So I really focus on technique, like mimicking other, like, other instrument. And the mijo, and the next one was, like, people, of course, I play kayagam, but I don't want people seeing me as a just kayagam player. I want to people see me as a Toyang Kim artist, you know, not just kayagam player. And I don't want to put it in the box again. So that was how I, and then a second thing is I don't want people to, oh, your sound's very exotic sound. Like, what do you mean exotic, you know?
Yeah.
Like all those things I need to fight with it. Like, and then this instrument is just this, you know, and then all this thing, I need to work on it. So even, and then inner talking about like what Joe said, I go really, really deep, digging why I feel this way, why I start kayagam, what does this mean, and all my trauma bring going on. Like, I really get through like seeing it. And, you know, accepting, swallow it, that's actually really long, hard, but after that, without that, I think I cannot be, you know, free. I will stuck there. I will keep talking about me. So mm-hmm. that was the step. And then to get rid of just become a Kaigan player. I do start composing. And then also the vocal, the funny thing why I sing, I never trained vocal, by the way. It's just self-taught, self-doing. It's maybe Korean karaoke, you know, in my undergrad and high school and musical. But the Tony Malaby, the saxophone player, like I play with him in duo. He invited me to play with his quartet and more bigger, large ensemble. And of course, the Kaigan, yes, now I'm using three mic, but still if you have a drummer, so many like brass instrument, like they're all banging that I cannot hear. And Tony Malaby said, "Toya, more, more, more." Like I really like physically like pushing myself and keep saying no, even I cannot hear already. So I yelling them like, "Can you hear me? Like, are you hearing me?" I'm yelling and audience love it. He love it. That's and then Toyon more and more. And then next time again, Toyon, will you sing? Right? Like, what are you talking about? And then that's how I became also sing. And then realized that the Kaigan, as I say, is percussive and very dot, and I want to connecting that dot and then start using my voice, which Kaigan can do, and then it be coming all the way here. After I break my limitation, like always feel like, okay, after this obstacle, another obstacle coming on. Like I think what that's also life. Yeah. And then, and that's the also very beauty of the life. So yeah, I'm keep going that.
It was like this just response to a moment that then sort of opens another door,
yes.
Right? And the singing, I have to say, is extremely powerful, you know, and I'm surprised that, in a sense, I'm surprised that you did not have vocal training because it's a very strong projection that you have. But now that I know the backstory, it's like, oh, you were struggling to be heard.
Yes.
So, which is, there's probably a metaphor in there. But now you use that opportunity to express ideas about yourself and then also more generally. So what does that provide in addition to like, you know, sustaining the note? What has that provided to be able to use lyrics in your music?
First of all, the vocal is, you know, it's motherhood of all the sound and all the instrument. So it's very, I realize it's very direct. And if I, even though I sing Korean, but everyone somehow gets it from my expression. And that's just very beautiful and then magical also to me. That through the vocal, I think I can balance of my music that what I really want to express it, I can like using or not add another layer of my music. So that's expanded more possibility. So yeah, and now I'm really love it.
'Wellspring,' you really have an all-star ensemble. Matt Maneri on viola and Tyshawn Sori on drums and Henry Frazier on bass. And these are all incredible interpreters and incredible, you know, they just do so much work with timbre and texture and they're, you know, incredible listeners, right? And so there's just so much power on this album that comes from the four of you just furiously listening to each other, you know? And I wondered if there was any part of that that was like you know, a revelation for you, or, you know, or was it just one more step in your trajectory?
Actually, this is behind scene that we never played before together. Just for, of course, I play each separately, but the, in the recording session, that was the first time we all meet and play together. But how I compose is not, I'm not thinking I'm going to compose for violin. I'm composed for like bass or drum. I'm more thinking about Henry's character, Mary's character, Taishan's character. I'm more caring about personality, who are them, rather than what instrumentation. So I already have so much trust and belief from that. So that's not a problem. I know like how they're gonna play and interpret. So, and then it was right. They brought so much magical moment. Even like, I even asked Matt Merrick, Matt, can you make me cry? And right away, one note, and right away, like, oh my God. Yeah, so it's all coming from the love and trust and belief, yeah.
Before we let you go, I can't resist the temptation to ask, since you are seated behind your instrument, is there anything short that you could play either to demonstrate, you know, a sonic idea or one of your compositional ideas?
Yeah, sure. First of all, I want to talk about background of the Kayagam, that the Kayagam is invented in Kaya era, which is 6 BC, so 1500 years ago to 2000 years ago, that much long. And the actually other jitter like Gujeong, Chinese jitter, Koto, Japanese jitter, they're using like some fake nail here and then play this way. But Kayagam is not using any nail clip. And then the Koto is, the string is made of nylon. And Gujeong is made of iron. And the Kayagam string is made of twist silk. So it sounds more warm. And more, that's why it's very like easy to bend because of the tension release. Yeah. So, and then I actually want to show you this, that, ooh, can you see? Here's a sky, human being, and there's a earth. So when you see the wellspring, my album cover, that's, there is a earth, the earth and moon, and which is, you know, and human being, that's the, even our ancestors think the sound is coming from, is our universe, sky.
Is that a traditional?
Yeah.
Okay.
Sound hole. So it's earth, sky, earth with the human. Yeah. I really love that, should I say theory? So, yeah, that's why I make my album cover with that, with the reflection of the moon and earth, you know. I mean, the earth was not the earth, actually, the earth, but, you know. So that's the meaning. And, yeah, I'm happy to play some little improvisation.
That would be great. Thank you. Yes. All right. Thank you so much for that. And yeah, let's have another hand for an exclusive solo performance. What a pleasure it is to talk with you, you know, just before this performance and spend a little slice of your birthday
on
stage and with Solar Myth. Thank you all for being here. One more round of applause for Doyeon Kim.
Thank you. 감사합니다.
So wasn't that fun?
Yes, it was. And it was pretty interesting for someone who hasn't really paid a lot of attention to her music yet. But she's given me a lot of reasons to want to hear it. And you too. Thank you, Nate.
Well,
great conversation.
Thank you. And as I said, Wellspring, this album on DAO Forms, is remarkable. You know, it's really quite stunning. I will say that at Solar Myth, she had a slightly different instrumentation, which was cool. On the album, she has Taishan Sori on drums and percussion, Matt Maneri on viola, and Henry Fraser on bass. And only Henry was in the band at Solar Myth. So on drums, Tom Rainey, who sounded great.
Wonderful.
And then instead of Matt Maneri's viola, she had Laura Cox on flute. And this is a terrific flautist who I know mainly as a member of TAC Ensemble.
Yeah.
But Laura plays in a number of new music settings. And in this circumstance, like, played all the flutes. You know, it was like there was alto, there was bass, you know, it was just a bunch of different registers and tonalities. And Doyeon talked a little bit about how she did kind of modify the arrangements based on the instrumentation. So it was a very cool performance. And again, it is an incredible album. So I was really, really happy that we were able to connect with her when she was passing through town.
Beautiful thing. Now it's time to dig something.
Yes, it is.
This I dig.
You know, last time, Josh, you gave us what amounted to a cliffhanger.
I don't know that it was a cliffhanger. I think I just needed to stop talking about French wine for a while.
It was a to be continued.
Yeah. And we're going to continue it now.
Okay.
So we were in Provence for most of this trip. And the AOC for Provence, Les Baux de Provence, is actually a really wonderful and relatively new phenomenon in France, at least as it relates to wine. And what they're known for is a lot of organic and natural wines, and they're really, really good. I want to point out one in particular, and that is there is a woman who runs a vineyard just near Saint-Rémy de Provence, which is where we were based for the week, where we left for our rando adventures mm-hmm. in Provence. And we weren't able to visit here like we were able to visit in Aix-en-Provence or Meyreuil for the Palette region for Chateau Simon. So we weren't able to do that. This lady is incredibly serious, and she doesn't want to be bothered by any of that because she's focusing on making great wines, which she does. Domaine Auvette, Hauvette.
Okay.
Every wine she makes is wonderful. Whites, the rosés, a lot of rosés in the south of France, especially in the summer. Mm-hmm. And she also makes a light red from the grape called Cinsault.
Oh, yeah.
C-I-N-S-A-U-L-T.
Yeah.
And it is a really, really elegant, light, expressive wine. And I'll leave it there because I could talk about wine for a while, which I did on the last episode. So I promised I would keep this one short. But I dig Domaine Auvette, and you can get a couple of the wines from her here in the U.S. I do believe that Kermit Lynch is the distributor for her.
Okay.
All right.
Well, I'm going to go in a different direction. You know, as we drop this episode, we are just, you know, starting into August.
Yeah.
And there's a lot going on in August, including the Newport Jazz Festival.
August and everything after.
There it is.
My Counting Crows reference.
Did not expect a Counting Crows reference from Josh Jackson, but, you know, this world is full of strange wonders.
I saw them, but let's not go there. Go.
There's actually a lot of really good albums dropping on August 8th. One of them, which I'll put an asterisk on one, is by the clarinetist Ben Goldberg.
Okay.
You know Ben Goldberg.
I do.
So Ben is dropping something called 8x8, which is not a reference to Jimmy Rushing.
It's slightly larger.
It's actually a series of eight different albums that he's dropping all at the same time.
Okay.
Eight.
That's a lot of clarinet.
Yeah. I'll give you the details of just a few of them so you have some sense. You know, these are all different. So there's one album called For Bobby, and the Bobby in question is Bobby Bradford, one of his mentors.
Yeah.
And it's a trio record with Greg Cohen on bass and Billy Mintz on drums. So already, like, that sounds pretty good, right?
Yep.
There's an album called Dog Hypnotic Duo with Kenny Wollison. Okay. There's a trio album with Myra Melford on piano and Danny Lubin Layden on trombone. And it's called Trouble Trouble, which was named after a song by Steve Lacy. Never trouble trouble till trouble troubles you. What else can I tell you? There's a quartet record called Just What You Thought You Wanted with Matt Hollenberg on electric guitar, John Abair on bass, and Hamir Atwal on drums. And on, like I said, there's eight of these.
Wow.
Apparently, there's a little bit of, like, cosmology here because, you know, Ben Goldberg, his full name, of course, is Benjamin. Benjamin and Goldberg each have eight letters in them.
Oh, boy.
And he was born on August 8th, which is 8-8. So, you know, he just kind of felt the eights aligning and decided to put it all together.
You'd think he would have played the piano.
Right. So that's coming. 8x8 from the terrific clarinetist composer Ben Goldberg.
I'm going to try to listen to as many of these as I can. You've already heard all eight, haven't you?
Well,
freak.
I'm getting there.
Okay.
Sometimes you dig in and sometimes you dig out.
Yeah, for sure.
The Late Set is a production of WRTI and made possible by WRTI members. Enjoy this podcast? Leave us a rating wherever you listen to podcasts. And be sure to subscribe and follow us on social media. The handle is WRTI Music. You can email us at editor@WRTI.org.
Our show is hosted by Nate Chenin, that was him, and Josh Jackson, that's me, and produced by Alex Arif. Robbie Webb is our assistant production manager. He mixed this episode. It was recorded at Solar Myth by Bo Gordon and presented by our friends at Ars Nova Workshop. Shout out, Mark Chrisman.
Our director of operations and production is Tyler McClure. Associate General Manager for Content and Programming is Josh Jackson. And Bill Johnson is WRTI's General Manager.
Stop by WRTI.org to see everything else we're cooking up in Philadelphia and beyond. And we'll see you soon.